Hello, Stephen, are you there?
I'm here.
Great. Just by way of introduction, my name is Noah Millman. I'm a senior editor and featured blogger at The American Conservative. And you, Steve?
I'm Stephen Walt. I'm a professor of international affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School and a contributing editor for Foreign Policy magazine.
That sounds an awful lot more impressive than senior editor at the American Conservative.
It could be overrated.
We're going to have sort of a free-ranging conversation, I think, about this moment in U.S. foreign policy and where we stand. It's an opportune time to have it since we're about to change secretaries of defense. I'm not sure if I should say unexpectedly. It's probably not very unexpected that Chuck Hagel is on his way out, whether voluntarily or involuntarily, and everyone's speculating about who will replace him and whether it makes any difference. I'd be curious to know from your perspective whether you think Hagel's tenure turned out similar to or significantly different from what you anticipated when he was first nominated, and whether he made any kind of a difference.
Well, I think he made a modest difference. I guess I would say I was a little bit disappointed in that I saw him as, for lack of a better term, a bit of a more realist voice, someone who was clearly very skeptical about America's penchant for unthinking interventionism. And in that sense, I think many of us hoped that he would begin to pull the United States into a somewhat more restrained or somewhat more sensible posture in different parts of the world. And I think he was, a voice in that direction, but in one sense he was, blindsided or at least surprised, as many were, by events in Syria, events in Iraq, and what now appears to be an extension of the American presence in Afghanistan. So one could argue, in a sense, he was rowing against some tendencies in American foreign policy and American defense policy that have proven to be very hard to correct. And in that sense, he's become sort of, I think, the fall guy for many of the criticisms that have been directed at the Obama administration. But he's certainly not to blame for those failings. And I would even argue they are failings that are broader than, say, the White House itself or even the administration itself.
One thing that surprised me a little bit, I know it's been cited a bunch of times as one of the sort of the indicators that he of disappointment that the Obama administration had with him. It was a comment that he made right when the Islamic State first kind of burst onto the front pages, that after a number of successes that they had in both Iraq and Syria, that something to the effect that this is the biggest threat to every interest we have at this point. This was around the same time that the Obama administration was kind of trying to poo-poo the Islamic State as a serious threat. I think the line is something about being a junior varsity basketball team of foreign threats. Was that surprising to you at all that Hagel was the one who was off message being so alarmist about that? Does that say anything about sort of the degree to which he was truly thinking as an alternative to the way American foreign policy has been conducted lately, or what was your feeling at the time when he made those comments?
I was surprised by it, but in one sense, because again, it does seem to be at odds with the positions he's taken in recent years and before he became SecDef. But I think that it does reveal a certain enduring tendency in American national security policy now, that there is a real mindset that's, I think, very hardwired into the American defense establishment and the American foreign policy establishment to see threats in virtually every corner of the world, and generally to overstate them or magnify them or not be able to keep them in much perspective. So if it's not, ISIL, we're told that Iran and a possible Iranian nuclear weapon would be a threat to everything that is good and holy in the world. We're told that, hackers could take down the entire American power system, and that's an enormous threat. We saw the overreaction to Ebola, which was obviously a serious problem and something to be addressed, but there was a sort of, you know, very exaggerated sense of what kind of a danger it posed here in the United States and in many other parts of the world. So in a sense, you know, for Hegel, if you're sitting atop the Pentagon, you know, keeping your bearings and not succumbing to this sort of tendency to exaggerate dangers and misrepresent them almost reflexively, I think is a perennial problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one that has, I think, caught the Obama administration in a number of occasions, and he was just one example of that.
Right. Do you think that that's, you know, that kind of hysteric streak is something that the president himself shares, or do you feel more that it's that he is reacting to that as a sort of a given of American political life and needs to respond to it from a domestic political perspective? Or what do you think, because there's clearly been a change from the early years of the Obama administration to where we are right now in terms of how that administration speaks, going from a sense, or at least this is my, the way it reads to me, is that he came into office advocating for a change in direction, not so much in an anti-interventionist direction, but simply in with a goal to having better relations kind of across the board, both with allies and with adversaries, and has over time drifted more into a position that is familiar from previous occupants of the office. Is that just who we are as a people? We expect our leaders to be in charge of everything and managing the world?
Well, I think that's certainly the default tendency for much of the American sort of foreign policy community, those people who either make their livings in that world or who pay very close attention to it. There's I think, a lot going on here. First, Obama's, I think, natural instinct is to be sort of cautious and deliberative and not overreact to things. That has been, I think, his great political strength throughout his political career, that he tended to remain very calm when other people were hyperventilating,
mm-hmm.
and tended to want to look at the long view. You know, where are we going to be in a year? Where are we going to be in 5 years? Let's not overreact to trouble. And I think there he understood correctly that the United States is very powerful. The United States is, by historic standards, extraordinarily secure. No serious rivals anywhere near our shores, for example. And I think he even had a fairly measured sense when he came into office of what dangers were out there and how they were problems that needed to be addressed, but they weren't something that one needed to panic over. And then in a sense, if one took the long view, as he's said on a number of occasions, it mattered as much to make sure the United States was strong here at home and was dealing with problems inside the United States as it was for the United States to try and run the politics of, you know, countries or societies tens of thousands of miles away.
Right.
But I think Obama has had those instincts all along.
So
and also, I think, he's all had an appreciation for the realities of American power, that there are many things the United States can help accomplish, but there's some things that are probably beyond our wisdom or beyond our strength. That's where he started. But of course, he comes into office and he inherits a foreign policy establishment in the Democratic Party that was strongly committed to global activism, to solving problems, spreading democracy, advancing human rights, intervening in lots of different places, and a Republican Party that had also been heavily fond of that kind of thing, despite some of the setbacks we'd seen in places like Afghanistan and obviously Iraq. And then finally, he gets, the series of scary briefings that every president gets from the intelligence community about all the dangers out there and all the bad guys who are thinking about doing something harmful to Americans. And he understands that if any of those things happen, he's going to be in real trouble. So in some respects, I think Barack Obama is a beautiful illustration of how someone with fairly sensible instincts can slowly get overtaken by the general propensity for threat inflation that's built into our national security community. And what he's tried to do is address those threats in as modest a way as possible, as cheaply as possible, with drones and special forces and other things like that. But he has not been immune to the same belief that if the United States isn't running things in many corners of the world, that Americans in Kansas or California or Nevada or New Hampshire aren't going to be safe.
Right. There's two – I hear you saying a couple of different things in there, that this is partly sort of the nature of the presidency in the contemporary sort of media-driven era. If anything happens anywhere, everybody knows about it and everybody goes into a panic about it. Partly the nature of the United States vis-a-vis the world. We are so powerful that it's difficult to ever say, well, it's not worth our doing this, or it's not – or it's actually not something we can do. Possibly some things related to the character of the American people, or and it also sounds like you're making an institutional argument that you've got personnel within both parties, you've got personnel within the departments who are already committed to a certain vision and to sort of particular policy goals that preceded the Obama administration, and that arguably, you know, certainly this, I think there's an argument you can make with respect to Ukraine, wound up sort of leading the administration down a course that hadn't really even been particularly considered. One of the criticisms that Obama's opponents make is that he hasn't taken institutional control in the way that the most successful executives have. How strong do you think that critique? Strongly do you think that critique cuts vis-a-vis that particular side of this question? The, you know, are there people in state, in defense, in the CIA, and so forth, who are pursuing their institutional agendas sort of without regard to what the larger argument from the administration is about where America's interests lie?
Well, I think you're right. I am making something of an institutional argument, and it's not just the formal institutions of government. It's also the sort of surrounding penumbra of other organizations, including, you know, think tanks in Washington and groups that are sort of committed since their founding at encouraging global activism and encouraging American internationalism. So, yes, most parts of the U.S. government have an interest in the United States continuing to exercise global leadership. And in some areas, that's a good thing. It's not – the United States shouldn't be trying to withdraw from the world, which really isn't a realistic possibility.
And but no one's really advocating it either.
No. Exactly. I mean, genuine isolationists in the United States are a very, very minor, you know, a fringe set of groups. What I think you do see is people who recognize that the United States would be better off with a more restrained view, playing hard to get a bit more, using the latitude that our favorable geopolitical position gives us, and encouraging others to take a much larger share of global burdens, particularly when those other actors have much more at stake than the United States does.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, because who are the other actors we're talking about here? If I look around the globe, in the Middle East, what I would assume you're talking about is countries like the Gulf states, who are largely protected by the United States. And I think we know both the limitations from a practical perspective of what they can actually do, given the morale and readiness of their own armed forces, but I also my impression is that we're not particularly eager to see, you know, Saudi Arabia take an even more independent line. If anything, we're more upset that at the degree to which they've been implicated in all kinds of freelancing that's been against our interests. If you talk about East Asia, our largest ally is Japan. My impression is that the major reason that Japan there's a real ambivalence about whether it would be a good thing for the United States for Japan to take on more of a burden of collective security in its own region, given the historic relations there. Probably the only country I can think of where the United States might, where you might be able to sort of make the sort of burden sharing argument and say, yeah, it would be a better idea if the European Union, and particularly Germany, was more responsible for security in its own region. But what that mostly boils down to is policy with respect to Russia. So is that, I mean, does burden sharing ultimately mean, or does greater degree of burden sharing mean we want our allies to be more involved in global policing, or does it mean more things like, you know, we would like, you know, we're going to defer more to Germany with respect to how we deal with Russia and things like that?
Yeah. Well, I think that all of these things are involved. So in with respect to the Middle East, you know, we have this problem now with the so-called Islamic State or ISIL or whatever you want to call it. But this is not a threat to the United States in any immediate sense. In fact, it's hard to imagine how it could ever pose a significant threat to the United States. It's simply not a very powerful actor and not likely to become one. And to the extent that we worry about, you know, terrorists coming back from Syria or Iraq to the United States, that's primarily a problem for, you know, the Homeland Security people and for our law enforcement folks. ISIL, to the extent that it's a threat to the Iraqis and to the Kurds and to the Turks and to the Saudis and to the Jordanians. They have real skin in that game. And instead of the United States immediately leaping to say, we'll take care of this one, we'll lead the charge, and then trying to persuade others to help us, we should be doing this exactly the other way around. We should be asking our friends in the region what they propose to do about this, and if we like their proposals, then we're willing to support them.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, we should be acting a bit more like a venture capitalist that is looking around and trying to decide whether to invest. If we like their business plan, then we'll invest in it, and if not, not.
Right. So suppose we had like a very – this would never happen, obviously, in a true diplomatic conversation. But suppose we had a very frank conversation, an unrealistically frank conversation with the government of Turkey, say. And suppose the counterpart of our, you know, diplomat or our military attaché there said, well, basically our view is – the Islamic State is going to take care of the Kurds, and we're pretty happy with that, and we think we can stop them from invading Turkey. So we're not really so worried about this as you would think. Suppose the Jordanians basically said, we're really worried about these guys, but we also think that it would be potentially catastrophic for us to be, in terms of our domestic viability, given that, you know, such a large percentage of our population is not Bedouin, and we're always nervous about the possibility of, you know, unrest domestically from our people. We think it would be catastrophic if we actually did anything substantive, besides which we're, you know, a relatively small country. I suppose the Iraqis basically said, well, you know, honestly, our army is completely incompetent and corrupt. The most viable forces we have are Shiite sectarian forces, and we're not sure that we'll be able to completely win. But certainly if we invited the Iranians in, we'd have a better shot.
Right. Well, the point is that every time the United States stands up and says, everybody out of the way, we'll solve this problem, we allow various countries with much more at stake and various movements with much more at stake to then misbehave. So the Shia population, the Shia government in Baghdad can continue to be corrupt and sectarian in orientation because at the end of the day, the United States will come in and protect them.
Right.
So, you know, similarly, we have problems with the Saudis doing, you know, both being concerned about ISIL, but also being hostile to Assad, and also perhaps engaging in other activities that actually encourage Islamic extremism. And they're allowed to do that because at the end of the day, the United States promises to protect them. What we ought to recognize is that our main interest is for the Middle East to remain politically divided. We don't want it unified under any single hostile power.
Mm-hmm.
And the Middle East has never been more divided than it is today. So we don't have a vital interest in intervening to try. We are experiencing technical difficulties.
Unfortunately, viewers, we are experiencing technical difficulties. I think we're back up, but I want to back up just a little bit to make sure that that we capture what you were just saying, Stephen.
Well, the central point I was making was that that the sort of the more the United States intervenes in places like Syria or Iraq, the less that locals have to do to take responsibility for their own situation. And
right.
And the ultimate solution to a problem like ISIL, of course, is the reimposition of some kind of effective political authority that obviously isn't, violent and engaging in massive human rights violations of various kinds. That's
right.
Not something that the United States knows how to do, as I think we have now proven, first in Iraq, but also in Afghanistan. We're simply not very good at creating political order in these countries, and it's ultimately going to have to be done by the locals, and they won't do it if we keep swooping in and providing them with the sort of assistance that allows corruption to persist and allows their own political dysfunctions to last.
I think I agree with that. I guess the only point I was trying to make is that we have a bit of an imperial, sort of a classic imperial dilemma, right? That we want to create incentives for the actors that are out there in these various different regions to get their own houses in order. So we don't want which we inhibit by taking responsibility for everything on ourselves. But by the same token, we're never entirely happy if the way they get their houses in order is not the way that we would prefer. And that's, I guess, what I was trying to highlight. Like, if we said to ourselves, well, we'd be perfectly comfortable ultimately if Iranian troops were in Baghdad. I mean, it's not optimal. It's not what we would prefer. But we'd prefer that to American troops. If we were, comfortable with the idea that the Kurds of northern Iraq might, either engage in a long running war with little outside support that they wind up surviving or don't wind up surviving, if we'd be comfortable with those kinds of outcomes, then we can sort of call everybody's bluff in the region. I mean, I guess I'd make – here's an analogy I'd make. Nobody did much of anything about the Congolese Civil War, which killed a lot more people than the Syrian Civil War or the Civil War in Iraq. Something like 3 million people died, and every country bordering the Democratic Republic of Congo intervened, and the rest of the world basically ignored it. That's one – one could imagine a Middle East that looked very like that, where the various parties, Turkey and Saudi Arabia and Iran, were left alone to sort of hack at the corpse of Iraq because it doesn't matter to people outside the region. Is there a conceivable world in which the United States would simply allow that to happen? And if not, what constraint does that place on our ability to sort of step back and say, you know what, you guys take the lead on this one.
Well,
we're not going to get involved.
Right. If the United States is not willing to intervene in conflicts where it doesn't have vital interests involved, let me start over. If the United States finds it unable to stay out of conflicts, even when it has no vital interests involved and even when it doesn't have prospects for a meaningful and cost-effective solution, but it still finds itself impossible to stay out, then we are in real trouble. All right, then we're going to constantly be waltzing into quagmires, and we're also going to lose whatever leverage we might have had over some of the parties in the region. We also, I think, have to recognize that there are going to be some parts of the world that are going through the kind of convulsions that portions of the Middle East are going through, where there isn't any easy solution, when there mm-hmm. isn't a cheap, quick, made in America kind of response. And in circumstances like that, the prudent thing to do is, in fact, to stay out. Just to shift gears a little bit to Europe, right? The fact is, the European members of NATO are still far wealthier than Russia. The European members of NATO spend more than four times each year what Russia does on its military. Mm-hmm. So the fact that Europe can't, on its own, provide an effective defense against any possibility of a direct threat from Russia, I think, is simply the consequence of 50-plus years of allowing European defense capabilities to atrophy. And that's something that the United States never really minded all that much, because we really wanted to run NATO, and if the European countries were relatively weak, that made it easier to do. The question is whether or not that's essential to do at this point, or whether or not we would be better off allowing European security to be handled primarily by Europeans with some residual American support. That might also, of course, make us be a little bit more prudent about extending promises to defend weak and vulnerable countries that are not necessarily vital American interests.
Georgia, Ukraine,
and you'd even, I think, want to throw in the Baltic states there as well. The fact is, we did all of this in a fit of enthusiasm when we thought Russia was weak and that we could do these things with impunity and that there would never be any security problems involving them. And that's usually not a good way to decide where to make security commitments.
I agree with you very much about that. Just to play devil's advocate there, I think it wasn't simply a rush of enthusiasm, but a sense that we didn't want, if you look at what happened after World War II, right, you had significant displacement of populations even after the war, right, as well as displacement of borders to line the new borders up, you might say, with what might be more functional sort of ethno-states. So you had, it was not a political problem to expel the German populations from a number of East European countries, because the Germans had started the war as a massive war of aggression. So this was the consequence there, the ethnic Germans from the former Soviet Union and what was then the Soviet Union, Poland, Czechoslovakia, and so forth, were largely expelled. There's a big Russian diaspora in country in the Baltics, in Ukraine, as well in sort of Central Asian countries. I think there was a fear that the sort of the post-Soviet period could feature a lot of conflict around those populations and an attempt to sort of prevent that from happening by freezing everything in place. You could argue that it backfired. But there was that, my recollection is sort of that was, sort of the policy logic beyond simple enthusiasm.
Well, that's right. And people, I think, had a very, optimistic view that if you extended NATO eastward as far as you could go and you incorporated all of these countries into it, that the, protective shield, in a sense, would be, placed over various countries in Eastern Europe and in the Baltic region, and therefore there would be no problems.
Right.
They would become stable democracies. Ultimately, the Russians would accept all of this, and Europe would be, as they, as the famous phrase, whole and free in perpetuity.
Right.
And the one place I think where we misunderstood things badly was to recognize, first of all, that at least in the Baltic states, these were going to be, they weren't strategic assets. They were going to be parts of NATO that were going to be difficult to defend if Russia ever regained any of its strength from the weakness it was in the 90s. So they weren't making NATO stronger. They were just extending the number of things that NATO had now promised to protect. Second, the key to making all of this work was to build a positive relationship with post-communist Russia. And I think if you look at the past 20 years or so, I mean, there's blame to be put on both sides, but the United States, and to a lesser extent its European allies, have done a variety of things that made it, I think, impossible for virtually any sensible Russian leader to have a close and positive relationship. We essentially adopted a policy of, what's ours is ours and what's yours is negotiable, and we don't really have to take your security concerns very seriously because you're too weak to do anything about them.
Or concerns that aren't really security related, but relate to, you know, what you might say sort of the psychological position of the Russian people, you know, things like the situation in Serbia, which had no value to Russia, but psychological, but significant psychological value.
I don't think it was just psychological, because even issues like that, which I don't think were vital interests, were signals to the Russian leadership as to what extent the United States and others were willing to take note of their concerns, take note of their sensibilities. And even if it was a minor issue, when we tended to sort of run roughshod over their concerns, it made them wonder what we would do in other circumstances as well. You could say much the same thing with respect to Libya. You know, Libya was not a vital interest for Russia, but they had gone along with the UN resolution that allowed us to begin to use force against Gaddafi. We then blew past the actual terms of the resolution, used it for regime change, and it's not like they were deeply in love with Muammar Gaddafi, but they had to wonder what this meant about American intentions. Would we be willing to take advantage of any set of circumstances where things lined up in our favor?
Do you think that was actually a surprise to anyone in Russia that the United States did that?
Yeah, I think
I mean, I assumed at the time that there was that the entire purpose of the intervention in Libya was to make sure that you wouldn't have a pattern whereby only friends of America, like the dictator in Tunisia, the dictator in Egypt, would fall, and people who had historically been seen as more hostile were able to sort of kill their way to remain in power, like Gaddafi, like you could even argue, you know, Assad, and so that the only reason to intervene was to topple Gaddafi. Do you think anyone in Russia believed the idea that this was a humanitarian intervention?
I think they did. I think they thought that this was designed to perhaps set up a balance of power between the regime and the rebels, arrange for some kind of negotiated settlement. I mean, the concern that the Russians, and I might add also the Chinese, have had all along is not wanting to live in a world where the United States and its relatively tame allies get to decide who governs in different parts of the world. This is not a precedent you like if you're in Moscow or Beijing. And of course, if you look at the past 20 years, the United States, you know, eventually was able to get Milosevic out in Serbia, was able to peel Kosovo off, toppled Saddam Hussein, certainly would have tried to topple some other governments if Iraq had gone better, eventually gets rid of Assad, etc. So from a Russian perspective, and again, I'm not defending Russian foreign policy here, but from a Russian perspective, they see a powerful United States that is willing, when it is possible, not in every situation, but whenever possible, to topple people that we don't like. And that's not a world that most other countries, and certainly countries like Russia, want to live in. And they've gone to some lengths now to try and, you know, throw some sand in the gears of that project whenever possible.
Right. I kind of assume a higher degree of cynicism on the part of the governments of both Russia and China, and less susceptibility to the idealistic motives that we articulate for our policies. So I kind of assumed when they agreed to the Libyan resolution, I kind of assumed that they gamed it out something along the lines of, well, you know, this is most likely not going to work in one way or another. Either they're going to, violate the terms of this, and we have a talking point on an issue that we don't actually care about because we don't really care what happens in Libya. So we can prove to the world that the Americans are, you know, lawless imperialists in an area that matters much less to us than Syria does, or any pick your other, you know, pick any number of other countries that matter more to them, or that maybe they really mean this, in which case this is going to be sort of a ridiculous farce, and we can watch them have a ridiculous farce.
Well, I think it's I mean it's cynical, but it's cynical with a strategic core to it, and that it's rather that the Russians and the Chinese and other states, which by the way we should remember are still much weaker than the United States is, certainly true in the Russian case and even true in the Chinese case, have been worried ever since the end of the Cold War that the United States was going to be able to exercise an enormous amount of unilateral control. And of course, many Americans, I think, succumbed to that belief too, that we were so powerful that we could pretty much dictate the terms in lots of different places. And the Russian position all along has been that international politics will go better if there's a degree of bargaining, if we work these things out at the global level, if we, you know, if there's a solution to be had when there's a revolt in Libya, then that's a solution that shouldn't be imposed arbitrarily by American cruise missiles and drones and intervention forces, but it rather should be worked out collectively within the Security Council among other great powers. Now, it's cynical in the sense that this is a way for Russia to protect its own interests. It's a way for Russia to try and gain a place at the table in various places. But the key we have to understand is that on some issues, not many, but on some issues, Russia does have cards to play. Mm-hmm. And having Russia going to enormous lengths to cause trouble for us, say in Syria, or in the case of Ukraine, going to enormous lengths to protect what it regards as vital interests in Ukraine, has actually led to outcomes that we don't like.
Right.
So had we adopted a somewhat more diplomatic, a somewhat more negotiation-based approach all along, we might actually be in better shape today. And I might add, places like Libya, Syria, and Ukraine might actually be in better shape today.
Right, which may or may not be anybody's top priority in this particular conversation.
I wanted to go back to the larger question, though.
Please.
Which is, I think, this issue of the ability of any administration, you know, the Clinton administration, the Bush administration, or now the Obama administration, to be able to set a set of clear foreign policy priorities and then stick to them for more than about a month and a half. So you remember that when George Bush became president, he wasn't going to do nation building, and he was going to focus
a humble foreign policy.
He was going to have a humble foreign policy. He wasn't going to do nation building, and he was going to focus on relations among the great powers. I think, you know, between the lines there, it was getting us ready for a competition with China, which people in the administration took pretty seriously back then.
Yeah.
And, of course, that whole project was completely blown out of the water by 9/11. And Bush finds himself doing nation building in Iraq and Afghanistan and is, of course, completely unsuccessful at both.
Right.
Similarly, Obama comes in. They're going to pivot to Asia, get us out of Iraq, win the good war in Afghanistan, and set us up for the future, which is much more Pacific-oriented. But of course, 6 years later, what do we see? We see that we're back going into Iraq, we're extending in Afghanistan, and the pivot to Asia is more symbolic than real. So what it leads me to wonder is the sort of what's going on with the American foreign policy process that makes it so difficult for presidents to figure out what our key priorities ought to be, and then keep their eyes on the ball, even though occasionally you do have to adapt to unexpected events.
Well, I think I tend to go at that. I think some of the things you said earlier about the media environment, some of the things you said earlier about the institutional inertia within the government and in among groups that are outside the government, I think it'll all play a part in that. I do tend to think that this is a classic imperial problem. Right, that this is very, very familiar. It is very difficult if you are the overwhelming power on the globe to affirmatively say, we're the overwhelming power, but we would rather see other powers get stronger than have to take care of everything ourselves. We would rather have, in Europe, that would mean, for example, we would rather have less influence over events in Eastern Europe and would rather see Germany and Russia come to some kind of workable arrangement between them and stay relatively out of it. We would rather see a stronger Iran if we could make sure that that was not as hostile an Iran. We would rather see a Latin America that was more independent and less a playground, or playground is the wrong word, but less amenable to American intervention. I think that's very difficult if you're in the position as the strongest power to say we'll take that risk versus the risk of having, you know, relatively pliant allies and relatively familiar and weaker enemies, but having all the responsibility yourself. I also think that's a difficult message to deliver politically.
Yeah, I think there's no question. I think that you're right. I mean, Britain actually faced the same problem in the early part of the 20th century and into the 1920s and 30s. It still had this vast empire, but it had trouble figuring out, you know, do you defend Hong Kong? Do you maintain its continental commitment? How do you deal with India, et cetera? And when you've got all these far-flung commitments, weighing them becomes, I think, trickier. And any time something happens anywhere, there will be lots of people standing up and screaming that you have to do something about it.
I mean, and we're much more powerful than Britain was at that point relative to the rest of the world. But by the same token, we don't have the United States, which Britain did. I mean, we were not formally allied with them before World War One, but even before World War One, I think most people would have assumed that the choices were between remaining neutral and siding with Britain, to say nothing of before World War II, the idea of taking the other side and siding with Germany in either war was always a very small minority view. So to some extent, they had a resource that the United States doesn't. They were in hock to what was fundamentally a friendly country. If the United States winds up, the United States is currently, fundamentally in hock to, primarily China and Japan. Right. But it's a somewhat different situation.
The only problem I have with that sort of way of thinking is it assumes that it is somehow some kind of a foreign policy victory for the United States every time it gets saddled with some intractable burden. In other words,
no, it's not. It's just very difficult to see what would be a victory. I think what I would say is that. Let's look at why it's so difficult for us to come to an agreement with Iran, right? On looking at it narrowly, it's difficult because Iran has certain incentives to try to maintain options in these nuclear talks that the United States would prefer to foreclose, and so it's a something of a zero sum negotiation. It's difficult for us to accept something that they can look at as a partial victory, and it's difficult, obviously, for them to accept something where they surrender, to the United States on all points. But looking back more broadly, the difficulty is that even those forces and factions within Iran that want to see a less confrontational policy vis-a-vis the United States and the West more generally, have no desire to constrain Iran's freedom of action or its ability to develop independent power. And ultimately, the United States could accept a thoroughly friendly Iran relatively easily, right? Iran that just switched sides and said, now we are, a pliant ally of the United States. And it could accept a weak, ally, a weak Iran that's still hostile. But it's difficult for us to spin as a victory, saying, okay, we're no longer in conflict with this state that still professes itself thoroughly independent and even antagonistic in a variety of ways and seems to be getting stronger.
This is, I think, you know, sort of one of the central problems that American foreign policy has had and been commented about for decades, which is we tend to have a very black and white view of the world.
We do.
We tend to see countries as either evil or our friends, and without recognizing that for most countries, and particularly countries that have some capabilities, they're likely to be, you know, occasionally places where we agree and have interests in common, and there are going to be other points of friction, and it's the task of diplomacy to manage those points of friction in ways
right.
that don't cause much trouble. And I think our entire approach to Iran has been myopic for decades, because there were relatively few insurmountable interests at odds, I think, and certainly in various periods, beginning in the mid-1990s, the Iranians have clearly been interested in working out some kind of modus vivendi with us in various ways. Now we've become, you know, completely obsessed with Iran's nuclear program to the point that we may or may not be able to actually negotiate an agreement that sort of we can live with and they can live with. And there, I think the United States has simply failed to recognize that the long-term objective is, first, to create a situation where Iran never feels an incentive to actually develop nuclear weapons. And I think there are ways to construct our relations and Iran's relations with others so that they never feel like they have to push beyond it. We focus on the technical aspects of the deal without looking at the broader political incentives. And secondly, I think Americans have missed the fact that if we had a better relationship with Iran, not necessarily a warm and close one, but a better
right.
relationship with Iran, that would enhance our leverage with other countries in the region who now take us for granted. And moreover, over time, that's likely to do more to, if you want to call it, undermine or force the clerical regime in Iran to evolve than continuing to treat it like a pariah.
Well, I think that's definitely true. I'm maybe a little more skeptical than you are about the sort of incentives not to nuclearize, given sort of the degree of prestige vis-a-vis its own neighbors that that having atomic weapons would confer. But there are obviously significant incentives on the other side, and those incentives arguably would operate more powerfully in the context of something that resembled normalization than in the context of continued hostility.
Here's something to think about, right? If Iran is able to open relations up with the outside world, get its economy going again
right.
in a serious way, it is going to be the most powerful country in the Persian Gulf region, just on the basis of resources,
oh,
education, and population.
Yeah.
If it's the strongest country in the Persian Gulf region, it would actually be better off if the region were non-nuclear. And because its overall capabilities are going to be so much greater than everybody else's. If it crosses the nuclear threshold, there's some risk. I don't think it's a certainty, but there's some risk that some of its neighbors,
Saudi Arabia or Turkey or whatever,
exactly, would follow suit. And that, to some degree, then neutralizes Iran's superior conventional assets, superior size. So if I were a really far-sighted Iranian, I would want the ability to go nuclear if I ever had to, if
right.
I really thought someone might try to overthrow me. But I wouldn't actually get that close to the line, and I certainly wouldn't cross it, because
right.
I'm going to be in good shape being essentially a latent
yeah.
nuclear power. And I think that's where Iran has tried to head, and we should encourage them to go in that direction, not cross the nuclear threshold, and then try and build a good relationship with them.
I agree in broad strokes with what you're saying. I want to return, before we run out of time, to something that we were talking about at the very beginning of this conversation, which was sort of the institutional analysis of where, on the assumption that you were right, which I tend to agree, that President Obama came into office thinking we want to have a foreign policy that is less militarized and less and restores better relations internationally and relies more on diplomacy and has wound up in a very different place. That one of the drivers of that has been sort of the institutional imperatives of the government as a whole and of agencies within it. That points to the difficulty of turning the aircraft carrier. I mean, inevitably, it takes a long time, but it takes even longer if you keep course correcting back to the original course. The two politicians, one in each party, who seem most interested in turning the aircraft carrier on the Democratic side would be former Senator Jim Webb, who just recently announced that he's actually forming an exploratory committee, and on the Republican side, Rand Paul, who I don't believe has formally announced anything, but everyone assumes is running for president. And it's not, I think, an accident that they are both, you know, sort of relatively speaking, gadflies, not people who have built strong institutional connections. Those are exactly the sorts of people who you would think would be most capable of looking at these kinds of large-scale problems from the outside and thinking outside of the Washington consensus. But unfortunately, I tend to assume that it also makes them not only less likely to win, which is, you know, unquestionably the case in with Webb, and I think is also the case with Paul, but relatively less able to implement their policy goals if they were to win. Is there a hypothetical sort of person? Who should we be looking for as the kind of person who could effectively, even if slowly, turn the ship?
It's a great question, because you would have thought Barack Obama would have been it. Particularly given the timing, right, that he takes office with Afghanistan a disaster, with Iraq a disaster, and with the economy in free fall. And if there was ever a person who was not of Washington and a moment in which really called for, a major rethinking, that would have been it. And we've seen, of course, that he, in a sense, got captured by the traditional conventional mindset, even though he's tried to do it, you know, kind of on the cheap or in as risk-free a way as possible. So I think that, you know, it's hard to sort of identify the person. But I think you really put your finger on the larger problem, which is that you can't come in just as president and with maybe two or three advisors in the White House and turn this ship around. Because, of course, you've got to staff the rest of your administration, and the people you're going to put in all those other jobs tend to be people who are strongly committed to American global activism. Right. And that's what happened to Obama, right? He had Hillary Clinton, who's very much an interventionist. He's had Susan Rice as his national security advisor, Samantha Power at the...
Well, those are his people.
Right. Those are very much his people, and plus lots of other people who were not part of the Obama machine,
right,
but still believes that there sort of isn't any problem in the world that shouldn't be primarily solved first and foremost by the United States. And so even, you know, if I waved my magic wand and, you know, Jim Webb or Rand Paul or someone like that were elected, they would have their hands full trying to get the overall establishment to take a somewhat different view. And it involves, I think, actually educating the American people that some of the things we do in foreign policy and some of the interventions we've taken have not made Americans safer, have not made Americans more prosperous, have not, in fact, put us in a better position, and they do have a cost in terms, at a minimum, of opportunity costs, things we could have done at home or things we might have done in other parts of the world. And until we get a president and a team that's able to sort of see and establish a set of priorities and then explain why, when a problem happens in a place that doesn't matter, we're not necessarily going to react to it. We'll watch it, we'll keep an eye on it, but we won't necessarily react to it and make that stick. You know, that's what we're ultimately going to need. But until that comes along, I think you're going to see a continuing cycle of the United States getting involved in places without having a clear idea exactly why.
Yeah. Well, and unfortunately, even if you get somebody who has exactly the right temperament and exactly the right understanding of the institutional issues. If you got a Dwight Eisenhower, you know, Eisenhower himself left office warning about a military-industrial complex that he had done very little to prevent the growth of, and which became a much more dramatic feature in American life in the decades since then. I wouldn't be shocked if Barack Obama sounds a somewhat similar note on his departure and warns against a variety of processes operating within our government, whether we're talking about the national security state or the surveillance state or whatever, that he's done much more to entrench than to restrain.
Right. And Eisenhower had the advantage, of course, that it was the Cold War, and you could at least establish that, look, their overwhelming priority has to be dealing with the reality of Soviet power and making sure that we maintain a balance of power in Eurasia. Nobody could be quite sure how dangerous international communism was, but you knew sort of where to focus your attention.
Mm-hmm.
Today, a central challenge we face is the attention deficit disorder that tends to afflict whoever is running American foreign policy. You know, today it's Sudan, tomorrow it's Syria, the next day it's the East China Sea, and none of these things seem to focus the mind sufficiently to give people a clear rank order. But I would be thinking much more long-term about the rise of China. I would be trying to make sure that that relationship was handled well and that our partnerships in Asia were retained, which is one of the reasons I keep getting worried when we start squandering resources in Central Asia or the Middle East.
Right.
But the point is that any president has to set some priorities and, you know, make some hard judgments and then explain them to the American people so that when we act or when we decide not to act, it's clear why we're doing it.
I can't disagree with that. Well, and hopefully in your own writing and the writing that happens on the American Conservative, more of that education is happening, but it is a slow process.
Yeah, that's right. We can only write so fast.
That's right. Well, thank you very much. This has been an enjoyable conversation.
This was lots of fun talking with you, Noah. Let's do it again sometime.
I look forward to it. Take care.
Right. Bye-bye.
Bye.